Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and thank you for joining me today for It's All About Food. I'm very excited about today's program. I think it's very important, the topic and the project we are going to be talking about. I'm going to bring on my guest, Eric Tonsmeyer, who is the award-winning author of Paradise Lot and Perennial Vegetables, and the co-author of Edible Forest Gardens. He is an appointed lecturer at Yale University, a senior biosequestration fellow with Project Drawdown, and an international trainer. He has studied useful perennial plants and their roles in agroforestry systems for over two decades. He's the author of The Carbon Farming Solution, a global toolkit of perennial crops and regenerative agricultural practices for climate change mitigation and food security. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Yes. Now, I was very excited when I first heard about Drawdown. Climate change is something that is, I'm trying to find words to describe it, but we need a lot of urgent work in this area if we want our species to continue comfortably living on this planet. And our current administration, governmental administration here in the United States, seems to want to turn things backwards when it comes to protecting the environment. And it's scary. It's sometimes depressing. And when I heard about Project Drawdown and read the book, I felt hope. I felt inspiration. And I really appreciate everything that's happening with this work. So thank you.
Well, that was one of the goals of the book, is to lay out that there are lots and lots of solutions, that many of them are already being done on a large scale and are already actually growing rapidly and don't necessarily have to wait for governments, or aren't waiting for our government to move forward.
You know, I spoke with Carl Pope a few months ago about the book, The Climate Hope, with our former New York City Mayor Bloomberg. And I was inspired with that book to hear about all of the things that are related to business that are, that will work in our capitalistic society, meaning that they will be affordable and economical to make changes that improve environment. But Project Drawdown goes a lot further and gives us many ideas on the household level, as well as the commercial level, and so many things that we can do worldwide.
Yes, yes, we do. It's really, it's a very interesting project to have been part of, because you have some things like composting that are very much a household level sort of activity, or LED lights. Then you move to, let's say, a more industrial scale, looking at alternative concrete. Most of us in our home, maybe that's not something we're going to do every day, is use a different recipe for concrete. And then we have some things that are really at a much larger scale, like forest protection, which is maybe more of a national level issue. But there's something for everyone in there. Hopefully,
something for everyone to feel empowered and make a positive difference that hopefully will
and
help.
Now more than ever, that's important.
Yes, because so many of us feel like it doesn't matter what we do or what we say, but it does. Okay, so this is
It's really
All About Food, and I want to focus on food. You've got a number of categories in Project Drawdown: energy, women and girls, buildings and cities, land use, transport materials, along with coming attractions. And there are so many things we could talk about. Let's concentrate on food, because this show is called It's All About Food. And even while we focus on it's all on the food portion, all of these other topics still impact food, because as the climate changes, our way to manufacture, our way to grow food and create food is affected tremendously.
Absolutely. And transport it and keep it cool. so it doesn't go bad. All of those things are very much is a really neat aspect of the project, the degree to which we were able to look at integrating all these solutions and not just looking at one on its own in isolation, but saying, how will they help or hurt each other?
And before we go further, I want everyone to know that you can get all of this information at the website drawdown.org. It's all there.
So it is indeed. We have not only the individual solutions, but also a sector summary for the food sector. So you can read through in great detail and look at charts and rankings and a lot of the calculations that went into the results that are reported in the book.
Yeah, I love data, and this is a very complicated project. I have not gone into the charts and tables, but I'm sure there were a lot of assumptions made. I know it's hard to collect uniform kinds of data worldwide, but still, it's a very important starting point. Can we talk about the number?
Data, yes.
The number one ranked solution, and you rank them by a number of different things. So even before we talk about the number one, can you just talk about how all of the solutions are ranked?
Sure. So essentially for each of these solutions, there was a research fellow who did a sort of a big, great big literature review, and we've developed these Excel models that you can enter lots of data into. So let's say for this carbon sequestration rate of such and such a practice, we might have 10 or 20 or 30 data points from different places in the world, and it sort of runs meta-analysis and gives us a good plausible number to work with that kind of data entered. So we tried to cast a very wide net for data to get fairly conservative numbers to work with.
The number one solution, which I think will surprise most people, is refrigerant management.
Yes. Well, it wasn't the sexiest of all of our solutions. Oh, and we ranked them by their, ultimately we ranked them by the total number of gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent reduced between 2020 and 2050. So over a 30-year period, which ones have the biggest impact? Number one is refrigerant management. If you think back to when we were dealing with the ozone hole and we switched the kinds of gases we used in refrigerators and air conditioners from something that caused ozone destruction to something that doesn't, a set of gases that don't, unfortunately, we switch into something that has absolutely unbelievable impact on climate change. Some of those gases are 2,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So the issue with refrigeration, which very much touches on food, is to, one, to develop replacements for those gases, and two, with all of the units that are out there now, when they reach their end of life, we need to safely and carefully remove the gases that are in there without leaking a bunch of it and either treat them or reuse them. So that's a massive global project right there.
That's massive. I remember talking to someone from Greenpeace about this on the program maybe 6 or 7 years ago. They had a program about refrigerant management, and I was just floored to find out about it. And the worst part is the end of life scenario. I live in New York City. I see people putting stuff out on the street all the time, and it can be an air conditioner. And more people are getting air conditioners. They're less expensive over time. And what happens when they're done? So this is definitely a big issue, and I just hope we can manage it. I'm sure
really
it's
nice
different all over the world.
It's different in different places, it's related to food waste reduction as well, because in much of the world, food is wasted not because people didn't feel like eating it, but because of a lack of refrigeration. So it's closely tied with another solution. The good news on refrigerant management is an agreement was made, an international agreement was made last year that has pretty good teeth. So there is an international working agreement on refrigerant management, the Kigali Accords of 2016.
Well, what was amazing with the ozone hole in the environment is that was agreed upon by countries very quickly on what we were going to do about it. That happened fast. Mm-hmm. And we're not acting as fast with a problem that seems to be just as dangerous, if not more so.
I have what? Noticed that as yeah. well. Yes.
Why aren't we as scared anymore?
It may have something to do with the power and scale of the fossil fuel industry as compared to the ozone producing industry. I suspect it may be related to that.
Yeah, too much money. So you mentioned food waste, and that's number three of your solutions.
Yes.
And you've got how many total solutions are in this book? There are 80?
We ranked 80. Yeah. So food waste is a really, really, really big deal. It really is.
And you know, part of it is what we leave over that we don't eat in the refrigerator, but there's much more involved in food waste.
There is.
Right?
The first piece is that we are wasting globally somewhere around, let's say, 30 to 40% of food, which is a great big problem. One issue is that food, much of it ends up in landfills where it releases methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. But also you're talking about a very big piece of the world's farmland being used and emissions associated with agriculture that ends up being wasted. So we end up needing much more farmland than we should. And as the population increases, demand for food increases. We have the clearing of land, clearing of forests and plowing up of grassland for agriculture, which is a massive source of emissions. So by reducing food waste, that contributes in part to preventing deforestation. So part of the impact is from reducing the emissions from the agriculture. Part of it is from reducing emissions from landfills, and part of it is from reducing deforestation. So it really has a very powerful impact across those different parts of the food system.
Number four is my personal favorite. As a vegan, I want everyone to eat more plants. And number four is a plant-rich diet. Thank you for putting that in
yes.
there.
Well, you just can't avoid the math on that, really, can you?
No,
it's
you
not,
can't.
And it's not that we're saying there are that everyone should be vegan, and although the numbers on that are clearly very good, and it's not, we're saying that, and it's not that we're saying that there are no climate-friendly methods of livestock production, but clearly most people should be eating mostly plants. When you look at the, like for every, let's say, kilo of beef, you need 10 kilos of feed if you're going to feed that animal in a feedlot. So you're eating for 10. That just doesn't make sense. And with the amount of meat in the diet around the world increasing in many places as population increases, you just can't, it's not possible to feed people that much meat unless you massively deforest what remains of the world's land. And the emissions from that are just utterly unacceptable. So clearly plant-based diet, very, very high rank, and just slightly behind reduced food waste.
That's right.
And ahead of solar. Ahead of solar.
It's amazing. Yep. Reducing food waste. Three, plant-rich diet. Four, I feel like Robert Goodlin, he's deceased. He died 3 years ago. He was the lead environmental advisor at the World Bank Group for a long time. And he co-authored an article in the World Watch Journal that had to do with the impact of livestock on global greenhouse emissions. I'm sure he's smiling down on this drawdown project.
It really goes back to diet for a small planet as well.
Sure.
It's not a new concept that livestock are very resource intensive. It's just suddenly in this context, it gets more publicity, you might say. An important idea gets more publicity.
The numbers help. The numbers help that you've provided.
They do.
Yeah. I mean, Diet for a Small Planet, that came out in the 70s. Here we are almost like 35 years later. And we're still trying to get people to understand that message.
Yes.
All right. After plant-rich diet, I want to talk about trees. Now, a lot of people, when they talk about climate change, they simply say we need to plant more trees. And I've learned in this book how really, really amazing trees are. My favorite expression was the wood wide web. which came in the Hidden Life of Trees article.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fantastic. But there are so many different things that are related to climate change and trees. There are lungs, really. And there are so many solutions related to trees. Can we touch on some of them?
Absolutely. We really can't mitigate climate change without them. So the broad categories of ways we touch on trees, one is protecting forests that exist now, forests and mangroves and so on, and peatlands, forested peatlands. So number one is to keep it in the ground, keep the forest in the ground, protect the vast amounts of carbon that are locked up in these ecosystems. Then we have some solutions related to restoring forests. On degraded land, bringing forests back there. And we have some sort of forestry type solutions, planting timber trees, planting bamboos. And then there's a number of solutions that are agricultural solutions that involve trees, incorporating trees on the farm, which fall under the heading of agroforestry. So you might be integrating them with annual crops, which we call tree intercropping. They might be planted out on pastures, which we call silvopasture. The trees themselves might be the primary crop, as in our tropical tree staple solution. Or they may be really complex mixtures of different species of trees, like multi-strata agroforestry. So the classic example of that would be shade coffee or shade cacao growing under larger native trees, but can also embody more complex systems. One I visited recently had avocados and macadamias as the tallest trees, and then in the middle was a layer of bananas, and below that was coffee, which is a very delightful system. And if that's what we have to do to mitigate climate change, I'm all for it. I'll just say
it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. The multi-strata.
We're still figuring
scenarios.
Out how to do that here in cold climates, but many of these are very widely practiced today. They're just not really fully appreciated or understood. The scale at which these things are practiced isn't really widely appreciated, nor is the rate at which they're growing, which is quite impressive.
Mm.
So we try to give these tree-based solutions their due. Not that other agriculture solutions aren't very important as well, but the general trend is everywhere you can add trees without impacting the productivity of the farm, you should. And in many cases, it increases the productivity of the farm, sometimes quite substantially.
One of my least favorite words these days is efficiency. And many times we sacrifice so much for efficiency, and I like to put efficiency in quotes. Because we're doing so much damage when we're trying to do something fast to save money, make more money, whatever it is. And so I'm wondering, where do trees fit in with our giant agribusiness, the large farms, monocropping, that sort of thing? Or do we just try and change that?
Sure. Well, drawdown as a general principle, our approach is to try and kind of find each farm where they are and move them a step forward. So the next step for many, let's say, large American farms in Iowa is probably not planting out a high density of trees all through their farm.
Yeah.
It might be adding cover cropping. It might be applying compost and so on. With that said, there are many examples around the world of very large annual cropping operations incorporating trees at pretty high densities, rows of trees that their tractors and equipment can fit between ergonomically. In China, for example, we have 12 million hectares, which is, let's say, something like 25 or 30 million acres of princess trees intercropped with annuals. These are trees that are late to leaf out in the spring. So mostly they're growing winter grains like wheat under them that mostly mature over the winter. So there isn't actually that much competition for sunlight, and the rows of trees are spaced far enough apart to minimize competition. And what they find is that you're able to get the same production of the annual crops plus timber. Hmm. And building with wood is a really important solution because the wood itself in a building represents sequestered carbon. And when you plant new trees again in the field or allow those other trees to resprout, they begin actively sequestering carbon again. So we do have large-scale models, even in cold climates, of integrating trees with annual crops. And I feel like that's the wave of the future. If you want carbon, you want agroforestry, you want more trees on the farm. And maybe that starts with a border planting or a windbreak, and it slowly works its way into this end of the farm over a long period of time. There's places where it's too dry. There's places where it's too cold. It's not a one-size-fits-all prescription, but as a general guideline, more trees in agriculture is essential for us to do the job that's ahead of us.
Early in the book, there was the mention of the oxygen-depleted dead zones. And I've read about them. I had no idea that there were over 500 of them.
Uh-huh.
This is just devastating. And it's primarily due to petrochemical fertilizers putting too much nitrogen into our water supply, along with pesticides and herbicides. What are the drawdown solutions?
Excellent question. The first one is nutrient management. What's really interesting, not in a good way, but what's really interesting about chemical fertilizers is that they are routinely overapplied. So people are putting down more fertilizer than they need, often because the price is very low. Sometimes there's government subsidies and so on, as sort of like a risk management strategy. You think, okay, well, I'd rather put on too much than too little, because if there's too much, I'll still get my crop. And what happens when people overapply fertilizer is it ends up in waterways, it causes all this damage, and it off-gasses as nitrous oxide, which is 298 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So dialing back the fertilizer is number one. Just applying the amount you need is number one, which actually saves farmers money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one solution that looks at this. We also have a regenerative agriculture solution, which looks at annual cropping systems and how fertility can be provided on the farm with green manures, with compost application, and various kinds of organic fertilizers. So we can shift away from, and also our agroforestry solutions also include nitrogen-fixing trees, which themselves provide fertility. So there are a number of ways to get around this issue. And also our riparian buffers, which are part of our agroforestry systems, involve basically a strip of perennial vegetation like trees along waterways, which help to basically their roots suck up the excess fertilizer and use it to grow and keep it from entering the waterways. So we actually have four or five different solutions that look at this particular issue.
Okay, there are 80 exciting solutions that are presented in this drawdown project. Now, how is this information getting out so that people can really incorporate them?
Well, we're doing some radio interviews, which is great. And Paul Hawken, who is the editor and the mastermind and wrote much of the content, it's really his vision and his baby that we've all been contributing to. He is on the road constantly, and a number of our staff are on the road at conferences and so on, pounding the pavement, so to speak, for these solutions. There's been coverage on television. There's been coverage in magazines. We found lots of interest in the business and investment communities. We found some interest in the policy world. And I think we have, being on the New York Times bestseller list has been a really big thing in terms of generating additional publicity. And quite a few people have copies of this book at this point.
Fantastic. I'm just thinking in my own small world here, living in New York City, for example, I live in a co-op building, and I was reading about the green roofs and the cool roofs and thinking about how difficult it is to make change in my own building here. And there are so many of us living in New York City. We need help making change.
On the other hand, I would just like to celebrate what a fantastic job all of you are doing in having very low transportation emissions by living in New York City.
Yes, that's one of the reasons
I
live here.
Well done in that regard. Very well done in that regard. And I think people maybe don't give cities enough credit for that.
I know we complain a lot about our subway system here, but it's the best in the country. And it's over 100 years old, and it takes a lot of repair. And I would love to see the entire country filled with improved rail systems.
There is much, much room for improvement in the area of transportation.
Yep.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's to me, it comes back to what Al Gore has said, which is that the question is political will. And I think that's true at the building and the block level, as well as state and national and international policy levels. What we're doing with Drawdown is not laying out a political roadmap so much as providing a toolkit to people who are in those conversations and who are part of those decision-making processes to say, well, this is what we get to fight about now, or this is what we get to fight for now.
Yes. It's a good beginning. I don't want to keep you much longer, but you did mention Al Gore. And why isn't he talking about plant-rich diets, even though he's eating one?
I'm afraid I can't answer that question. I don't know, and I have not met him, so I couldn't comment on that. We're certainly all in debt to him for all the marvelous things he's done.
Yes.
And our hope with Drawdown actually is to bring attention to a number of these things that really have not been getting talked about much, like refrigerant management, like the agroforestry kinds of systems, to cast light on these neglected, powerful solutions. One that I really am a fan of and advocated for getting in the book is the women smallholders solution. We find that globally, female farmers receive a tiny fraction of the total amount of loans and technical assistance and other kinds of resources for farmers. And were female farmers to be brought to parity with men, it would greatly increase world food production to the point that it would actually avoid deforestation in a pretty significant way. It would be producing so much more food on those farms that there would be that much less land that would have to be cleared.
Yes,
so that hasn't
absolutely been
in the public conversation much either, but it's really important, really important.
Yeah, it's really important. I think of Wangari Maathai and all of her efforts in Kenya building, planting all
absolutely
those trees.
Absolutely.
When people told her she couldn't, and she did.
She sure did.
Yes. Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk to me. I'm very excited about this drawdown project. It gives me a lot of inspiration and hope and a plan of where we can go to make great change. Thank you for joining me, and It's All About Food.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, take care. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with the second part of our show. Heartglass, and thanks for joining me for the second part of this show. It's All About Food. That was really something else, the first part of this show, talking about Project Drawdown and the New York Times bestselling book based on everything that is on the website, drawdown.org. I hope you visit the website. I hope you can find numerous solutions to incorporate in your own life, so that we can all work together to turn around global warming and get control of our climate. And now I want to bring on one of my very favorite guests, one of my very favorite people on the planet. And that is Real Coal founder Gary DeMattei. Not only did he help me found our nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, but he is an actor, a producer, a director, a chef extraordinaire, and a bit of a nut.
Yes, I am a nut. That's for sure. Actually, I'm nuts and seeds.
That's right. Nuts and chews and seeds and nuts whatever. And seeds.
Well, you have to have beans, greens.
That's right.
Nuts and seeds.
Yeah, you're quoting Dr. Joel Fuhrman's G-bombs, greens, beans, onions, mushrooms.
Bleh.
Everybody knows Gary doesn't like mushrooms, right? Berries and seeds.
But I'm getting my mushrooms in a supplement that
That's right.
Dr. Fuhrman.
Immune Biotech.
Immune Biotech.
That's right.
So I'm actually taking mushrooms now. Of course, not the kind of mushrooms some of you out there are thinking right now, but I'm taking the legal variety of mushrooms.
Yes. So just in review, one of my favorite solutions happens to be number four in Project Drawdown, and that is eating a plant-based diet.
Yay!
And that's something we've just been pushing and putting out there since Responsible Eating and Living's been founded.
Oh, well, you've been doing a whole lot longer than that, Karen.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it for like 45 years.
And I want to interject something here. I want to congratulate you on not only the interview that we've just heard about Project Drawdown, but also on all the interviews that you do here on this program. I am here as a representative of autumn. It's autumn approaching. And,
autumn in New York.
And at Responsible Eating and Living, it's autumn time. And as the creative director, I always try and tie in recipes and things of that nature with the seasons. We've got a couple of great recipes that have just gone out in our newsletter, and hopefully you are registered to receive one of our newsletters, because we're going to be talking about the newsletter today, but there's a couple of great recipes that are perfect autumn recipes. And, you know, we need to start gearing up for that, right? Because the weather's going to get colder, the leaves are going to change, you're going to need some more choices to cook for your family that are appropriate with what's seasonal. Because if you're like me, you like to go out and grab the seasonal vegetables and things that are in season to share with your family. And the harvest is coming in. And it's just a great time of year for food and for
cozy soups.
And for cozy soups.
Yeah, so a couple of the recipes are soups using mung beans.
Right, but I wanted to finish this
saying
congratulations on you for all of the marvelous interviews and guests that you've had on this program, especially today's and last week's. Let us know a little bit more about last week's guest.
Right, it was a couple of weeks ago. The Dr. Sherzai, Dean and Ayesha Sherzai, they are medical doctors. They specialize in Alzheimer's.
And the book
is cognitive impairment. And they have a brand new book out, and I'm sure it will be a New York Times bestseller. It was released
on the 15th of this week, September 15th. It's called The Alzheimer's Solution. I hope you've heard the interview with them. If you haven't, please check our archives for that.
And it's all about recent findings about the impact lifestyle changes like diet, exercise, sleep, stress reduction, and healthy challenges for our brain support the premise of this new book, right?
Right. And surprise, surprise, eating a plant-based diet is one of the key components to reduce your risk of Alzheimer's by 90%.
90%.
90%.
And they don't tell you that, do they, anywhere else?
They don't tell you anywhere.
As a matter of fact, you are one of the first people to grab this this couple and have and interview them about their book. So I just wanted to congratulate
you
for that. I think it's something that needs to be said, and you're just really doing amazing work here at Responsible
Eating
Living.
Thank you. I've been hustling for this program.
Yes.
Because I really want to bring the best in food news to you, the audience.
Yes, our loyal listeners. And if you're a new listener here at Responsible Eating and Living, welcome to It's All About Food, Karen's weekly podcast on the Progressive Radio Network. Yay, Progressive Radio Network.
Yay, thank you.
Progressive Radio Network. We always want to give a shout out to them and to Gary Knoll, the founder of that great organization. And so welcome. And
welcome.
Karen's program now is not only live on Tuesdays, and it's also archived at the ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com website, which you can now, and have been able to for the past several years, download the app so you don't have to type it in every time you want to.
Yes, get the real app. Go to ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. Go over to the right side, scroll down a little bit. You can get the app for iPhones or any Android. It's right there. It's free, and we use them all the time.
Can you also get it at iTunes?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And it's free.
It's free.
Just like everything.
Did we say it was free?
Just like all of our information.
Everything is free.
It's free. And we're a non-profit, so you won't see any pop-ups. You know how you go to lots of websites that have recipes, and all of a sudden there's like this really annoying pop-up? Well, no pop-ups here. We do have a button that says Donate to Real, but just ignore that. But it is tax-deductible.
We have the anti-pop-up promise.
Yeah.
No pop-ups.
But it is tax-deductible if you ever did want to donate.
Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you today, other than the fact that it's autumn in New York.
Autumn in New York.
Is that I think the arts and creativity are essential components when it comes to bringing political messages about society, and that includes messages about food. And yesterday, we went to see a play in Manhattan called 1984. It's based on the 1949 book by George Orwell that many of us had to read. I read it, I think, in junior high school.
Do you know also a fact? I know you read it, and I know that I read it, but do you know that it's one of the most lied about books that people say that they've read, but they haven't?
Really?
Yes. And that's
how
serious.
Ironic.
That's serious. It is.
That's funny, because the book itself is about how we're lied to all the time.
Exactly. That is the irony there.
But a lot of people have been reading it recently
because
they're connecting the dots with the situation our society is in today with what was going on in this book.
So if you say you've read it but you really haven't read it, you should read it.
Or if see the play.
If you're in the tri-state area or if you're anywhere in the world and you have access to getting here soon because it's unfortunately going to close, come to New York and see it. And it stars a vegan, Olivia Wilde, and it also stars the incredible Reed Birney and the brilliant Tom Sturridge. And the supporting cast is amazing. And the direction by Robert Ickey and Duncan McMillan is stunning. The whole production is just...
One of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up is because one of the items in the story is reducing everyone's vocabulary. They come out with these new dictionaries with Newspeak, which is reducing the amount of words we have in our language. And most of us know that expanding on the vocabulary, expanding on our words, is a way to better express ourselves and have a better understanding of everything that occurs on the planet. Makes us more knowledgeable, intelligent. And so what they tried to do in this book is reduce everyone's vocabulary so that rebellious thoughts against the government are reduced and ultimately eliminated.
Right.
And believe it or not, This connects to food.
It does.
But before I get there, I want to talk about a word.
A word, okay.
A word which describes this play, right. And that is dystopian.
Yes.
How many of you know what dystopian means or can spell it? D-Y-S-T-O-P-I-A-N. Gary, can you tell us what dystopian means?
I will be happy to. Well, quickly, it's a great way to define it is to say it's the opposite of utopian. Everybody knows what utopian means, right? Or at least has a feeling, a thought when you talk about utopia. Well, dystopian is the opposite. Specifically, dystopian is relating to or denoting an imagined place or state in which everything is unpleasant or bad. Typically a totalitarian or environmentally degraded one.
Wow.
Let's say that one again. Environmentally degraded
and
one.
And we are living in an environmentally degraded society today.
Right. And it ties in with Project Drawdown, and it ties in with giving people the wrong information about why there's something called Alzheimer's and how it can be corrected with a proper diet, a proper plant-based diet. And
so in the story 1984, they talk about eliminating words, and they even eliminate the word bad and use ungood to describe all things that are bad. So this way they go from two words to one, good. And good, the opposite of good is ungood. The opposite of dystopian is utopian or utopia, a paradise. Yet when we have a word for each, it just expands on the comprehension, and I think it allows for subtle differences.
Right. Also, a really important thing to point out is we've already been dumbed down, and that's basically what we're talking about. We're being dumbed down by technology, and 1984 addresses that in a big way. But we all hold these little things in our pockets. You're probably listening to this program with a screen. 1984 talks about looking up from your screens. And that was chilling to hear that because it applies today. But also the dumbing down of words can easily be translated into Twitter and the emojis that have now taken over and the little
memes
are so, they make me really, they make me meme. I'm not wild about memes.
Yeah, the thing about Twitter and 140 characters, people tend to read headlines and not read the entire article and react to the headline without even knowing what's in
right.
it because we're so inundated with so much information. But that information is not necessarily truth. It's just a lot of stuff. And so here I'm connecting the dots with vocabulary with when it comes to food.
Right.
And for decades, this is not new. This is not new fake news. We've been fed fake news about food for a long time. We've been fed vocabulary to distort our comprehension about food. So when we look at
images that distort our comprehension about food.
The images too. But when we have something on our plate, which is a bloodied, murdered piece of cow flesh, and we call it
steak
or something else,
We call it steak and we play some really interesting music underscoring the commercial about the steak on your plate, a song, maybe something by composer Aaron Copland that says it's what's for dinner, and it gives you all of these images of things that are untruths.
Yes, or bacon. There are so many bacon lovers out there, and yet why don't we call it what it is, an intelligent mammal's murdered piece of flesh after they lived in filthy, horrific conditions.
Yes, we don't do that.
We don't do that.
There's an industry connected to it, and I think we're talking about money here. And so it's going to stop people from buying it. And talking about censorship, if you saw, and this is an old adage, but if you knew, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everybody would be vegan. So, I know many of you have heard that. And yet, there are many of you out there, I'm sure not listening to this program, but many of you out there that don't care. And so that was the scary part of 1984, that it really showed us face to face what drives this and why these things happen. Because a lot of you do care, but there's a lot of people that don't. And they don't want to be messed with. They don't want to have information. They don't want to have the truth. So, and a lot of that has to do with the way we've been raised and going back generations, that this is what my grandparents ate and this is what my great-grandparents ate, and these recipes were handed down to us generation after generation, and this is what we're going to do. And to not, it's as easy as, you know, to quote Gary Francione, it's difficult to go vegan because eating animals is like breathing out and breathing in, and, or to paraphrase him. And so it's not to your fault. And no. That's one thing we want. We're not passing judgment, because one of my biggest regrets about going vegan is I didn't do it soon enough.
Yeah, which is why we encourage anyone who's considering going vegan or eating more plant foods, do it now. Do it sooner rather than later, because you'll be so much happier.
Yeah, and you'll realize that it all connects.
Okay, let's...
like healthcare, for example.
Talk about healthcare.
Let's talk about the recent healthcare battle going on in your family. And I just also want to point out another thing about your incredibleness. That's probably not a word, but I'll make it up. That you've been doing triple duty, quadruple duty recently, the last few weeks. Your family has been going through some health crises, and your dad was just diagnosed with a health crisis. And so you've been... borrowing your parents' car and driving back and forth to Long Island to take him to lots and lots of doctors' appointments. And so, Karen, remarkable job.
Thank you, Gary.
And
you know, a lot of us go through this when we have aging parents. My yes. dad is 89 and my mom is 84, and I'm very lucky to still have them alive. I want to think that their diets have improved somewhat, having three vegan children in their lives.
Yes, your brother and sister are both vegan.
Yeah, but there's plenty of foods that they both eat that I don't think they should.
Well, in other words, they're not vegan.
They're
and
not.
They show no signs of ever wanting to be vegan, and that has to be and has been a source of frustration for you. But
yes.
You love your parents unconditionally, and... it's not that you've given up on them, because
I'm always lecturing.
You're always lecturing them on what they're eating and yeah. how it can reverse some of the crises that they're now going through. And so let's talk a little bit about your experience in the last few weeks with diners, drive-ins, and dives, because that's where your parents like to eat.
Yeah,
like
so after we go to a doctor's appointment, I take them out for a meal, and they tend to like diners.
Because they get a lot of food at a diner, and it's not expensive, and it's cheap industrial food that's probably government subsidized. It's all of the meat and eggs and white floured foods that a lot of...
And there's nothing I enjoy on the menu at any of these restaurants, but... Something Gary and I have been doing for a long time, especially with our parents, is we just go along with where they want to go.
Right. We don't want to put up a fuss.
And either we eat beforehand or we eat afterwards. You know, we might order something small just to be sociable. But
or we talk to the chef or cook or waiter or whatever and
sometimes,
say...
Sometimes, depending on the space, yeah.
Yeah, depends on the space. But as far as a diner, drive-in, and dive, you know, no, they don't really want to flex. So what is the one key menu item that... everyone can relate to?
Well, I go for the house salad. I don't want to go for anything cooked.
Right.
Because I don't trust them.
Right.
I don't know that they even know what's in some of the foods that they serve.
A lot of people don't, right.
And this way, if I'm ordering raw vegetables, I can see them on my plate.
Right. So everybody kind of is familiar, especially you folks out there who are plant-based and or vegans. You can relate to ordering the salad when you have to take the parents out to a diner, drive-in, or dive.
Yeah. So I get a house salad. Now, one tip when ordering a house salad, I do not recommend getting any of the dressings, the house dressing or any of the other dressings. They can have all kinds of things in them, like high fructose corn syrup, hydrogenated oils. They could have egg products, dairy products, artificial ingredients, colors, things that you don't want to put in your body.
Exactly.
So what I recommend is either you get ask for lemon to squeeze lemon juice on the salad, or I typically ask for vinegar. And these diners typically have cruets of oil and vinegar, and they easily put it on your table.
So let's talk about recently, most recently, your latest experience, which you actually wrote a piece about, and it's on our website, and I want you all to read it. But Karen took her dad. Tell us the story about your dad. Has been very down and out. Understandably, he was diagnosed with something very serious, and it has depressed him a little.
Yeah,
a
my dad's not a guy who's been known for depression ever. He's not. He just accepts reality and moves on. I think I got that from him.
Right.
And now he's acknowledged that he's depressed because of these health issues. And he's always been up for eating out, eating in a restaurant. And I would ask him after every appointment, where do you want to go? And the last few days, he's like, I don't care. It doesn't matter.
That is not like your dad.
Not like him at all. But the last time, a couple of days ago, he wanted to go to the International House of Pancakes. It happened to be across the street.
IHOP.
And so I took my parents there. And I ended up writing a piece about it, as Gary said, which you can see on the homepage of Responsible Eating and Living.
How long has it been since you've walked into an IHOP?
Oh, gosh. Probably 40 years.
Okay. So, Karen returns to IHOP.
Yeah. Well, so I discovered a lot of things while I was there. And, of course, I ordered the house salad. It looked very nice in the picture. It wasn't as nice when it arrived. The tomatoes were anemic. The lettuce was pale. And they brought a cruet of oil and vinegar. And I want to tell you, I never touched the oil for numerous reasons. One is it can be a genetically modified plant oil, genetically modified vegetable oil, which I don't want. You don't know how long that oil's been sitting out. We refrigerate all of our oils because oils go rancid.
Yes. And I recommend you refrigerate your oils, too.
Absolutely. So I didn't touch the oil. But when I went and touched the bottle of vinegar, it was sticky and filthy and disgusting.
I've been there.
You know, and that leads you to wonder what else in the restaurant is filthy and disgusting.
Yeah, lots of things. Trust me, because I've worked in the restaurant business and have owned restaurants and have managed restaurants. And it's, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, and then when I was writing this piece, I discovered that they often add some pancake batter to their omelet. So if you're an egg eater and you can't eat wheat or gluten, beware at IHOP because there very likely is wheat and gluten in your egg omelet.
Right. And I'm not going to give away the piece, but the bottom line of your piece, and your piece is really great, is International House of Pancakes is anything but international. I mean, there are no international pancakes and
represented on the menu. No, you just have one version of fluffy pancakes, and then you can add chocolate chips.
And what are some of those pancakes? And I'm going to segue into how people can find recipes and make them.
Oh, yeah. There are
some international pancakes, Karen?
The French buckwheat crepes, the Indian garbanzo bean flour soca, the Indian lentil flour dosa.
Right.
The Asian rice flour pancakes, often savory rather than sweet, but you know, you can make all kinds of things. And we have recipes at Responsible Eating and Living for all of them.
All of them, and then some.
Yeah, so the way that I got out my frustration while sitting there as my parents enjoyed their omelets and their pancakes with the high fructose. You know what I want to say.
I know.
The syrups that contain all of these ingredients.
The high expletive toast syrup.
I was tweeting to IHOP, sharing my hashtag IHOP moment.
IHOP moment.
And they actually liked one of my tweets. Now, it wasn't
liked one of your tweets.
It wasn't the insulting tweets. It was the tweet saying, please add vegan menu items.
I don't think you were insulting them. You were just pointing out the obvious.
Yeah. I would say, come to the 21st century, add vegan menu items, add gluten-free menu items, and we can help because we've got so many vegan, gluten-free pancake, waffle, and crepe recipes
for free,
you.
Like everything else on our
life.
But it's true that a lot of the larger chains out there now are going in this direction. They are getting vegan menu items. They are doing gluten-free menu items. They are really coming up to the 21st century, and IHOP is stuck somewhere back in the mid of the last century.
So that's IHOP, but something I want to bring up while we have 2.5 minutes left is to thank you, Gary, because while I've been running around to doctors with my parents and staying over their house from time to time, and then when I come home, really rushing to get all of my work done, you have been here supporting me with some wonderful food and keeping me well nourished so that I can do what I need to get done, and I really appreciate that.
Are you going to cry?
I'm getting
really?
Choked up. Yeah.
Oh, give me a kiss. Yeah. You're welcome.
You.
And thank you for everything that you do for the world and our little family here and our little organization, Responsible Eating and Living, which is now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, heading into autumn. A great time of year for recipes and food and the harvest. And keep looking at our page, because we're going to be posting a lot more wonderful stuff and a lot more great interviews are coming up. And get our newsletter. And thanks for being a support.
We have two new recipes with mung beans. And the reason why we're using mung beans is they're not the most popular bean out there, at least not in the United States. But they cook up very quickly like lentil beans, so they're a very convenient bean to use, and we have two great soup recipes for that. So we have just a minute left, and I just want to say thank you. Thank you for joining us here, and it's all about
food.
And
happy holidays if you celebrate the...
The Jewish High Holidays are coming up, and we have some wonderful recipes for the Jewish High Holidays. Check them out at responsibleeatingandliving.com in our
recipes index.
That's right.
Jewish High Holidays.
Yeah, and send us comments and questions at info@realmeals.org. We're here.
And go see 1984.
Yeah, or read the book.
Yeah,
because, folks, we have to stay on top of things. We have to stay educated, and we have to resist. And we have to insist on what is right and what is true and what is best for all of us.
And look up from your screens.
Look up from your screens.
2 + 2 = 4. Don't let anybody tell you any different.
That's right. Thank you for joining us. I'm Karen Hartglass with Gary DeMattei. This has been another episode of It's All About Food. Remember, have a very delicious week. Thank you.